It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And get your dialing fingers ready because this is a subject that that often brings the calls in. Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
All right, so what are we talking about today?
Ben, we're going to talk about the Homeowners Association.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, as many of us know, most of our home ownerships now many times are statistically tied into, you know, a planned community, a planned development.
Right.
And as a result of, you know, a subdivision that has planning that was developed by a developer or a group of developers, there is, you know, a homeowners association.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this begins many times with the developer declaring that there be a homeowners association.
Right.
And creating a nonprofit corporation under the North Carolina corporate laws for the Homeowners Association.
Mm-hmm.
The Homeowners Association then, like any corporation, has bylaws, officers.
Mm-hmm.
It has rules, if you will, and manners of in which it operates as
right.
a corporation.
Right. Has to walk and talk like a corporation.
It
We've
does.
Talked about this before.
It does. Mm-hmm. And so then to lay the foundation a bit more, there is then many times there was created at a point in time those things known as restrictive covenants.
Mm-hmm.
And these covenants of restriction, which kind of outline the way in which this development is to be developed,
right?
What the common areas are, what the responsibilities might be as
mm-hmm.
to homeowners, the way they're to maintain their property, etc., is in the restrictive covenants. And so the stage is set now, as one can imagine, for there to be conflict, if you will,
mm-hmm.
between the bylaws and the corporation, potentially,
mm-hmm.
and the restrictive covenants on the property. This is one area that we many times see. And, of course, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
We also are going to talk about, in general, just the enforceability of these covenants,
mm-hmm.
restrictive covenants. And there's a lot of case law in North Carolina that helps we lawyers understand the enforceability of these covenants. And we want to talk about that. We have a lot of these cases in our office. And again, to lay a bit more foundation, Ben, I mean, let's be frank.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our home, our listeners who are listening, their home is, in fact, you know, their sanctuary. It is many times the most valuable asset
right,
in
right.
their life. And they're paying a mortgage payment. They're working to own the property.
Mm-hmm.
It is home, after all. And therefore, there is a lot of energy, if you will. There is a lot of concern when things are not quite right in the neighborhood.
Yes, I would imagine. That's again, this becomes an issue that there's so many different parameters in court cases and precedent, lots of things that go on in
right.
homeowners associations because they're quasi-governmental operations.
They
right?
are. They're little democracies.
Mm-hmm.
And one more thing that we'll just add to the formula is that if you are a listener and you are concerned about your neighborhood, don't be ashamed of the fact that you are emotional about it
mm-hmm.
because most folks are.
Yes.
Okay.
Indeed.
Again, this is home. This is their neighborhood. And there's a lot of passion, a lot of energy
mm-hmm.
usually around these conflicts.
Okay. If you have a question you'd like to ask, you can give us a call at 800-818-2255 or our local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
There's a lot of terms to understand, right?
And this? Yeah, there's a lot of terms, like Cecil indicated, bylaws, covenants, mm-hmm. you know, restrictive covenants, common area, common elements, you know, a lot of these. Planned Community Act, you know, we can go on and on and on. And as Cecil indicated, you know, we are involved in a lot of these different cases. And Ben, you know, the way the questions come into us with regard to these type questions, when we're meeting with clients or representing clients, it would be, you know, if we're representing the homeowners association, maybe the board of directors is saying, well, this person just built a house 5 feet higher than what our covenants allow. We didn't notice that, or it wasn't on their application.
Oh, right, right.
When they built their house, we have a neighbor that's next door that's threatening to sue us because his view is being affected. What do we do? You know, that kind of thing. That would be a scenario from the perspective of the board of directors for the Homeowners Association.
And the other side is the homeower.
Right. Then on the other side, you know, maybe the homeowner, we're representing the homeowner, you know, with regard to that situation or a similar situation. You know, I built a shed like we were talking about before the program started, and now they're saying that they're going to do something about making me take it down. They can't make me do that, can they? You know, that kind of question, or a fence, or or they, you know, potentially something more serious like the height of the house is too high,
right?
You know, that type of thing. So we oftentimes get into a very deep analysis with regard to the particular set of facts that are brought to us by researching very closely, you know, the covenants themselves, which in the covenants is where the restrictions on construction or improvement or alteration or modification of your property would be found. But many times, and more often lately, I think, we see that homeowners associations are kind of putting in place their own set of rules and regulations, like your architectural guidelines, that type of thing. You know, and sometimes when you look at that, the homeowners associations do in fact get a little bit overreaching.
Right.
Because you might have some language in covenants that say that, you know, you can't modify your lot, modify your property without approval of the Architectural Control Committee. And there's some real broad language with regard to that. But
in the covenant, right.
Well, there's broad language in the covenant. And then what the Architectural Control Committee does in many cases then is sets up rules and regulations with regard to the respective restrictions. So, and sometimes those rules and regulations, like I indicated, are beyond what would be reasonable and beyond what a reasonable person would expect buying in this association. And that's really what it comes down to. Would the property owner be put on notice that they could not have a fence?
Right.
That they could not, you know, paint their house a certain color? That they couldn't.
Or sometimes just even the door.
Yeah. You know, or they couldn't have a certain type of door. Or they couldn't have a mailbox in a particular area. Or they couldn't park a boat trailer.
They couldn't fly their ECU flag.
Right. In their driveway. You know, would they be on notice by reading the covenants before they bought the property? Or would is the language so nebulous and so general in the covenants that a reasonable person would not notice that? Well, we get into that analysis, you know, oftentimes, and then, like I said, we look at these rules and regulations. Now, the rules and regulations are more something that's, you know, kind of not, you're not going to have like covenants that have general language in them, like you have to get approval of the Architectural Control Committee first. And then there's some very specific restrictions in those rules and regulations, like every house has to be over 2,000 square feet. Well, that kind of restriction needs to be in the covenants.
In the covenants. See, that's the difference that a lot of people don't understand between covenants and then
those rules and regs, right? Because you see, the covenants themselves will almost invariably have language in them that state that in the event that they are to be amended, then this is the process you have to go through. You either have to have two-thirds or usually 75% of the homeowners actually approve that particular amendment. Well, if there isn't that, for example, 2,000 square foot restriction in the covenants from the outset, but the association is trying to enforce that through some rules and regulations, well, what keeps the Architectural Control Committee from just changing that 2,000 square foot limit
to anything
at a meeting one night?
Right.
They can't do that. Okay. And our cases in North Carolina indicate that.
Okay, now, again, to draw the analogy then, you could say that the covenants are like the development's constitution.
And then covenants and bylaws together, I would say.
Yeah, yep. And then the governing body is then
board of directors
is applying them.
And a committee is the architectural control committee.
And the covenants are often, aren't they established by the developer in the beginning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're put on record before the first lot is sold. Otherwise, that first lot is not subject to them, that type
right.
of thing.
But that's why they can be amended, because as the development
changes and the property owners decide, well, this doesn't fit with who we are and that type of thing. Now, let me add one more layer to this complexity. You know, we talk about this more objective type standard, like 2,000 square foot house or more, that type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really shouldn't be in your rules and regulations, that type of or ARC guidelines,
right.
Architectural Control Committee guidelines. But the law in North Carolina is that if there's broad discretion of an architectural control committee, they would be allowed to restrict improvements on property as long as it's consistent with the common scheme or plan in the association. Meaning if they've never allowed fences.
Right.
Ever. They at least would have a strong argument that, well, we're not going to start allowing them now because that has been a common scheme or plan that has been established for the past 40 years. They might run into somewhat of a strong legal challenge, though, if it got to that point, if there's no language anywhere in the covenants at all regarding fences restricting them at all. So, you know, you can see that it sometimes we get into a gray area because we're interpreting the cases with our actual documents, and our documents were done by an attorney somewhere in an office at some point in time, 30, 40, 20, whatever years ago.
Right.
And a lot of times they don't jibe completely.
So if the covenant said, back to the Architectural Review Committee, says they're going to have authority over these issues.
Right.
That could be in the covenant.
That's correct.
And then whatever they determine in those issues would be, would probably fly.
Probably, depending on, you know,
as long as they weren't outrageous.
As long as they weren't outrageous, but specific restrictions, though, within reason, you know, it'd be hard for them to police and enforce very specific restrictions, like the 2,000 square foot issue,
right.
like I mentioned a moment ago.
Okay. Yeah. All right. We'll have more to come in a moment. If you would like to call in and ask your questions, 800-818-2255 or
247-7282 or 353-4674.
More to come in just a moment on Let's Talk Legal, brought to you by Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law, online at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome to the program. Good to have you along with us here on Coastal Daybreak. And, of course, every Tuesday morning, Let's Talk Legal from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. And we're talking about homeowners associations and the sometimes confusing language there.
You spoke earlier, Ben, about changing the restrictive covenants, modifying them. That's very difficult to do once the lot owners in the subdivision outnumber the number of lots that the developer owns.
Once they take it over.
Correct. We've been involved in these from the get-go at times, and the developer, you know, would in fact make some tweaks to the restrictive covenants even after some small percentage of lots have been sold. But once, as you say, the subdivision is turned over to the homeowners, and they own the majority of the lots in the subdivision, then it's very difficult because of what? Because why? Because we're dealing with democracy at
right,
that point.
Right.
You know, one lot, one vote, and we don't have a block of votes, see, as we do while the developer, you know, if there are 100 lots, the developer sold 30 of them, he's still got 70 of them.
Right. He can control that.
He's got some control with one person.
And in many cases, until the developer sells out a certain number of lots, he might have 3 votes per lot and everyone else only has 1 vote per lot.
Correct.
Something like that. There's a transition at some point in time indicated in the covenants many times as to when that change takes place. It may be indicated in the bylaws, too.
And you've indicated before, these covenants are drawn up under a particular state statute, and so it's not just out of the thin air.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the covenants, you know, I don't know about state statute so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're drafted, you know, almost they're going to be by an attorney,
right?
You know, and
right.
they're going to be working with the developer. What are you trying to accomplish there? Those kind of things. And it's, you know, imperative that when you're establishing a homeowners association to have those covenants put on record before lot one is sold, because lot one, like I indicated a moment ago, 2, 3, 4, or 5, if the covenants are not on
right.
record, they won't be subject to the restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens sometimes. We've seen that happen in our title work where there was a mistake that a lot or two or three gets sold before the covenants were put on record.
And, oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And then in that, once that happens, then the only way that the property would be subject to the covenants would be for the new owner mm-hmm. to voluntarily subject them to the covenants.
Okay.
Because he holds the title.
Right.
You know, at that
right.
point in time. You know, we've seen situations before where certain lots in a subdivision were not included in the covenants mm-hmm. by mistake. There was a problem with the plat map, a problem with the legal description, and maybe a certain section got left out. And that's kind of a two-way street, though, mm-hmm. because, you know, you think you're in a subdivision and you're not.
Right.
But there are benefits in many cases to being a subdivision. Now, if the homeowners association is trying to get you to tear down your fence,
right,
then you may want to take the position, I'm not in it. You know, now, it just depends on the circumstances.
You can have areas that have covenants on property, but not are subdivisions, right? I mean, they're not.
Usually some of these
older
subdivisions, you'll have some covenants or some restrictions, but maybe they're not organized.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you know, you really don't have a homeowners association established. I mean, so then you get into the issue, well, who really is going to enforce these,
right.
you know, anyway?
Right.
I'll give you an interesting, as we conclude here, mm-hmm. I'll give you a real-life example, and it's a little bit off-point, but it's interesting.
Let me have you hold that.
Sure.
We'll take that break so we'll have enough time for that, too, coming up in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, talking about homeowners associations. And you know, these often raise some questions, so if you would like to be involved, you can call us at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Hey, welcome back here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And Cecil, you had a real life.
Well, example. Ben, you're talking about a restriction on mm-hmm. property,
right.
on land.
Mm-hmm.
And the most common example are these restrictive covenants, and particularly in the, quote, modern era that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
But, Ben, absolutely, you can put restrictions on lands. And lawyers have to read deeds very carefully,
mm-hmm.
Particularly deeds back in older time periods.
Oh, yes.
Where, you know, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, where there were all sorts of restrictions
mm-hmm.
that were included in the deed. You know, this particular live oak tree,
mm-hmm.
this particular family cemetery. I mean, the list is just on and on as to restrictions that can be placed on a particular piece of property and not necessarily in, you know, a real glamorous way, such mm-hmm. as a set of well-drafted restrictive covenants.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with that said, this week, and I bet this nice guy is listening to the program this morning. He told me he was going to, but he was in the office yesterday and he has a wonderful piece of property that he wants to eventually
mm-hmm.
go to his child because it's family property.
Right. Right.
But he's gotten married and they're very happy in their marriage and he wants his wife to have, a life estate in that property. and for as long as she would like to have the life estate.
Right.
She might not have it for her whole life if he were to die,
mm-hmm.
Soon through a mm-hmm. tragedy or something. But if that were to happen, you know, he wants her to be there for as long as she would like to be.
Sure.
But he wanted the restriction added that if she were to get remarried
mm-hmm.
or if she were to cohabitate, then under those conditions, her life estate would terminate.
Hmm.
And so in our initial conference with this client, I told him that I was going to need to research whether or not that restriction
mm-hmm.
was enforceable.
Right.
Because of the fact that that is an alienation, as we lawyers call it, on the use and enjoyment of property.
Mm-hmm.
And it may likely not be enforceable for public policy reasons. It was an interesting little research project, and we came back with the answer is, guess what, Ben? It is enforceable for a husband or wife to set forth that parameter or that restriction within a deed or other document when they are married.
Hmm.
But if they're not married, then that restriction will not hold. So suppose you're a father
mm-hmm.
and you say, well, I want my daughter or son to have a life estate in this property, but I do not allow them to get married and or cohabitate. If they do, then they forfeit their life estate. That would not be enforceable.
Okay.
So see, you can see what we lawyers do. Sometimes it's splitting hairs.
Mm-hmm.
It was intriguing to find that it would operate and be enforceable within the context of a marriage, but not otherwise enforceable.
Hmm.
But that is that's a restrictive covenant.
So back in this case, then if it's the wife who's going to have the life estate, but he has passed away. You know, is the marriage still existing because she would benefit from?
Yeah,
some
the
of
time
his.
That it was established, you would be fine to do it the way Cecil
right.
says to do.
Yeah,
it.
Okay, that's right. fine. Time right. the time yeah. it was established.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But
gotcha.
I think the takeaway from this, though, is that,
right.
you know, we can put restrictions on real property, but there are certain public policy issues we have to take into consideration.
Well, sure.
Where
in
we
past,
have,
there were racial restrictions on
oh,
covenants.
Exactly. You can't just
can't
put
that.
Any
right.
kind of restriction
yeah.
on property. But if we're talking about this is my own lot and I never want a house over 3,000 square feet to be built here,
uh-huh.
well, why not? Mm-hmm. Put it on there. I mean, you can do that. I don't know why you would, but, I mean, you could do that type of thing.
Right.
But we have to take into consideration, you know, the restrictions mm-hmm. that we're putting on. So, I mean, what Cecil's talking about is more like a life estate with a retention of certain rights.
Sure.
But it's very similar to the covenant type situation as far as restricting the title in some way.
In all of this, you just, you're come to the conclusion that you need the right advice at the right time. And that's why we have folks like Harvell and Collins, attorneys of law, online at harvellandcollins.com and available for you at 252-726-9050.